It's a very, I've got a very unstable setup today.
It's all stacked and balanced.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Little DIY setup.
It's two candles, which has a glasses case and my phone box on top of it.
Sturdy.
Yeah. Who needs a tripod? You know. No dick jokes, please. Not this early in. Christ. Right, on that note.
Game face.
Yeah. Hello again, everyone. We're starting a new little mini series, and this is hopefully the first of many, that is called Rum Fundamentals. Yeah. There's a joke in there somewhere. We'll figure it out. So this is kind of the first, this new little series that we're doing. So today we are going to be looking at kind of the raw ingredients, I suppose, of rum. And we're going to be talking a little bit about some fermentation as well.
Nailed it. Yeah, I guess what we're trying to do with this is basically cover all the bases. So when you're thinking about alcoholic, well, we're talking about any sort of like spirit products, there's a sort of general thread of stages that run through them all. So what we're aiming to do is cover the basics at each stage. Of course, at each stage, there's a million and one different rabbit holes that we could jump down and go more in depth and talk about specifics and things like that, which we'd be more than happy to do. If people do have any questions or want us to elaborate further, yeah, we'd love to do that. But I think given the few podcasts that we've done so far, we've just kind of been rambling and getting a bit geeky about rum. We kind of looked back on that and realized that there's a lot of things that we discuss or we reference that if you're sort of a little bit more new to the category or just spirits in general, it'll kind of go over your head a little bit and it's quite hard to follow. So what we want to do is use this series to basically give everyone a basic framework on which to work. And as Andy said, kind of makes sense for us to do it in chronological order, I guess, of how rum is actually, you know, made and produced. So in terms of the bases we're going to touch on, yeah, it's going to be kind of selecting and processing raw materials. After that, we'll touch on fermentation. Then we'll go to distillation. And then finally, we will look at post-distillation practices. So when we're thinking about rum, it's going to be the likes of filtration. We're going to look at aging, selecting different vessels for aging, whether you're going to maybe like finish things in different casks or you're going to, you know, use a few different vessels and blend together to create different outcomes. And we will also no doubt tread the rocky terrain of, you know, adding colour, adding flavour, adding sweeteners, things like that. So yeah, we'll hopefully try and do a well-rounded picture of the entire process.
And try not to piss any producers off in the process.
Yeah, yeah, we'll stay impartial. We'll just cover all bases and then yeah.
Something like that. People can make their own decisions after that.
So yeah, Andy, feel free, kick us off. Where does the story of rum begin in terms of manufacturing?
So pretty much all rum will be made from some kind of component deriving from sugarcane. So sugarcane is a crop that is grown that is part of the grass family, but it kind of looks a bit like bamboo. So it's kind of quite tall, thin, kind of quite fast growing sort of plant, really. Basically, it kind of originated in New Guinea, so really couldn't be further from where a lot of people associate rum making with these days in the Caribbean. Couldn't have originated much further away, to be honest. And it kind of eventually sort of worked its way around the globe via, you know, a few different sources. But the person that kind of introduced it to the Caribbean was Christopher Columbus, in the late 1400s. Nailed it once again, Jack. yeah, and he was kind of the first person to introduce sugarcane to the Caribbean, and he introduced it first to Haiti and the Dominican Republic, as we know them now.
Yeah. So I think with sugar, it can really be grown anywhere, but the hotter the climate, the more it's going to thrive, essentially. So typically it'll take anywhere between sort of like 9 and 24 months to, like, you know, fully grow. Typically in the Caribbean, it's usually only harvested like once a year. There are some more like subtropical climates, maybe like South America and things like that, where it can be harvested a couple of times a year. But in terms of a crop that grows, it doesn't take overly long to fully mature and develop. And what is quite useful with sugarcane is that if it's harvested in a right way, you can actually cut it where you're not cutting it right at the roots, and it will allow the sugar to regrow. So you can farm it quite efficiently. I think that a lot of producers do sort of eventually cut it out at the roots, but they'll probably get, you know, 6-8 years worth of regrowth and reharvesting before they decide to, yeah, you know, fully rip it out the roots and start again. And as far as I'm aware, that's more for the sake of the soil rather than the actual quality of the sugar that keeps regrowing. So unlike other raw materials that are used in spirits, so agave for me always springs to mind when you think about tequila and the agave plant, that can take, you know, 7 to 30 years to fully mature. More often than not, it's, you know, pulled out of the ground by hand, and then there's a bunch of things you need to do with it before it's ready to go. With sugarcane, for the most part, it can just be basically farmed in bulk, and then it's ready to press and, yeah, get the juices out.
Yeah, I mean, it's been domesticated since about 4000 BC, they think. We've been farming sugarcane for quite a while, so I think it'd be a pretty solid process by now. So.
Tried and tested.
They've worked out all the kinks, hopefully, by now.
Yeah, exactly. So in terms of the actual raw material that producers are going to be using to start the process of making rum, basically have two main options, kind of have like a sub-option in there as well. So once you actually have the sugarcane itself, that will be pressed, or it's often called milled, will be flattened out, pressed, and the juice that is extracted from there, that sugarcane juice, is one thing that will be used as a base. Option number two, or kind of like a sub-option from that, is that juice will then be heated up and basically concentrated to make a sugarcane syrup. Some producers prefer to do this because it means that they can actually store that raw material for quite a lot longer. If it's condensed down, yeah, it can be kept. The actual sugarcane juice that's fresh off the press needs to be used pretty quickly. So, yeah, I guess that's just personal preference, and also access to the crops and whatnot, and availability. And then the third and final option is molasses. So molasses is basically a byproduct of the process of making granulated sugar. So for anyone that's seen it before, molasses, it's basically like jet black. It's like very tar, treacly, like, I don't know if you'd even call it. It's certainly not a solid, but it's not a liquid either. It's very thick. Yes,
very exactly. Goopy.
And it's got kind of like licorice-y sort of like smell and taste to it. And yeah, producers will often use that as well as for a different style of rum.
Yeah, that's probably, molasses is probably the more well-known kind of rum style that you'll see quite a lot, certainly in the UK anyway, although we've got sort of a bit sweeter palates. And it's kind of used, probably say for 90% of rum, really. And then the sugarcane juice variants can be used in these making agricole, which is usually from like French-speaking islands in the Caribbean, or like Mauritius, for example, is another one. Another quite a big agricole producer. And then they also use the sugarcane juice to make cachaça in Brazil. So there's kind of two very different styles, and you will definitely, if you try, like, if you tried an Angry Cola, if you haven't before, and you tried it side by side with a molasses-based rum, you'd certainly be able to tell the difference if they were made in exactly the same way, and the only thing that was changed was kind of what was used to begin with. It's going to be a huge difference in flavour. I think sugarcane juice stuff tends to be a lot more vegetal, as they say, so you get a lot more of that kind of grassy notes in there, and sort of even like hay and things like that, and it's a bit lighter, a bit kind of a little bit more fruity in some aspects, but kind of like a bit more like green apple sort of fruit rather than some of the molasses based stuff is kind of can be like sort of really heavily like grilled pineapple and passion fruit and the ripe tropical fruit. Kind of sugarcane juice stuff tends to be a little bit more sort of crisp. It's probably a good word for it.
Yeah. So the idea from all of that is the producer is selecting the raw material that is going to be, it's going to give them their most wanted outcome for the final product. So it's how that they go through this initial stage of fermenting all of this mixture and, you know, then distilling it. They're basically using these processes to, just manipulate the overall outcome of what the final product is going to taste like. So the key thing that's kind of important for people when selecting a raw material is basically like the storage of carbohydrates. It's very important for anything that is used to basically have a lot of carbohydrates in there for yeast to feed upon. So again, we've spoken about this before, but it's kind of like a little analogy is not the right word, but it's a description that you kind of gave to me when I was first looking into rum. And I don't know why, but it's just always stuck with me, and it kind of like articulated it well in my mind. So if you think about the little Pac-Man, the game where he's going around the maze and he's eating up all the little white dots, he's the little yellow head, face, mouth thingy. You kind of described yeast to me as the Pac-Man. You said, imagine that it's going round and it's introduced to this mixture and it's eating up all the sugar. And for want of a better phrase, it's farting out CO2 and it is weeing out alcohol. And that is basically the process of fermentation.
I can't wait for my book deal.
It should be. I've told you before, it should be in a textbook, mate. Makes perfect sense.
If we teach these things to high school kids with that phrasing, the test scores would be through the roof. I'm just throwing that out there. But yeah, Jack does have a very good point about sort of yeast, and yeast is kind of, without it, we'd all be very sober. Kind of really, whether you're drinking beer, wine, you know, spirits, anything, it kind of all stems from, all the alcoholic content of everything stems from yeast. So it's very important, and it can also affect a lot of things flavor-wise, you know, as well as our sort of raw ingredients. So,
well, when thinking about yeast, you've got your kind of like three key types, if you will. So variant number one that's probably most widely available is often referred to as brewer's yeast. It's used in a lot of different processes. It'll be commonly used purely due to the fact that it's so readily available. It's very, very robust. I mean, I don't really know any other way to describe it. It's just quite diverse in the sense that it can cope with a lot of different environments, can't it, and things going on when we're referencing, you know, temperature and that sort of thing.
Have a stab at the name, Jack. Go on. It's your time to shine.
I'm no good with these. I know it's Saccharomyces I always get.
Yeah.
It's the rest of it that I have trouble pronouncing.
I think it's Saccharomyces cerevisiae.
Nice. You see, make it sound sexy.
I can make anything sound sexy. Don't worry about that. but like Jack said, it is, it's very hardy in terms of what it does. It's probably one of the most well-studied organisms in science. It's very easy to easy to breathe, I suppose. It's very happy living in quite a wide range of conditions, which is, it is good for kind of people wanting to use it in terms of sort of fermentation for booze, essentially. It's very, sometimes you'll put these certain yeasts under a little bit of strain regarding one element, like whether it's, you know, acidity level or oxygen or temperature, anything like that. It's going to have an effect, and it's potentially going to sort of slow your fermentation down, whereas certainly this brewer's yeast will keep on going pretty much regardless of the conditions, which is good. It's good. It's also very consistent, which is another really important point. If you're churning out millions of bottles a year of rum, you kind of want them all to taste the same. If it's, you know, if that's what you're known for. So kind of people use it to, for consistency as well, really.
Yeah, yeah. So that's option number one. And number two, some producers actually opt for the unique strains of yeast. And there are a lot of quite notable examples that have their own patented strain. Patented? I don't know. Whatever. They've got their own strain that they own and is their own. So Bacardi, for example, have their own yeast strain. And essentially what these producers are doing is they're spending a lot of time, energy, resources into studying yeast, studying how it's interacting, how it's working. And eventually through, I imagine, what is a lot of trial and error, they have their own strains that they are very, very familiar with. They know exactly how it's going to react and how it's going to work. And again, a lot of the pros that come from that is like what Andy touched on before. You're going to have a lot of consistency. You're going to have a lot of homogeneity between all the products that you're producing, because when you introduce that yeast to your molasses or your sugarcane juice or syrup, you know exactly how it's going to interact and work. And hopefully you'll know how that final product is going to turn out. On top of that as well, the kind of added benefit from having your own unique strains is if you find they do something particularly weird and wonderful, yours, of course, is going to be the only product that, you know, ends up deriving that outcome, because you're the only one that has that strain and can use that strain. So, as I say, pros got a lot of consistency again and some unique outcomes. However, it can, I imagine, be very costly and time-consuming.
Yeah, you can also kind of use these things for sort of greater efficiencies as well. So, if you spend a lot of time kind of researching these yeast strains and kind of trying to breed them maybe with some of the yeast strains that work a bit better under certain conditions, you can get to a point where you're going to have a super efficient process, which again is a good thing, you know. From a business point of view, it's going to save you a lot of money.
Yeah. So the third and final kind of option is basically the antithesis of the previous two we just spoke about. So yeah, big words. So yeah, it's going to be the use of wild yeast. So a lot of people aren't aware, but we actually have yeast around us all the time, just naturally it's filling the air. And what some producers will opt to do is utilize this, and rather than placing their yeast with their molasses and water mix or sugarcane juice and water mix in a ferment, like a fermenting tank that's sealed, they will actually leave them out in open air vats. And basically what that means is that the mixtures will interact with that yeast, that wild yeast in the air, and it can produce some very, very quirky results. So unlike what we just discussed, you know, pros of this is that it's very cheap in a sense that it's not really going to cost you anything to do and try it out. However, the outcomes can be a lot more unpredictable and also a lot more difficult to keep consistent,
because it'll tend to be a mixture of different species of yeast. So there's like over 1500 different species of yeast that are out there that we've discovered so far. No doubt there's some more, but obviously these will kind of, if you're using quite a lot of different species, as you probably would using wild yeast, this wild yeast method, you're going to get sort of different outcomes from different types, essentially. Yeah. You're going to get some of these different flavor molecules kind of coming through.
I was just going to say, kind of bearing all that in mind, from what we've found so far, typically producers that are using this methodology tend to be doing sort of batch runs, so they're not the mass producing producers. They're typically producers that are doing stuff smaller. They're doing smaller batches. If they release the same kind of runs, you know, sometimes they fully acknowledge the fact that they are going to vary slightly. So depending on the time of year that it's being made and things like that, from batch to batch, things like ABV flavor can fluctuate slightly. And if anything, I think it's something to be embraced. I think that's a really good and like interesting element. I think that as long as it's being acknowledged and the consumer knows, then it's not a problem whatsoever. Obviously, you can see why that would be a big issue with producers that are, you know, filling supermarket shelves, for example, and things where there's been bottles sent all over the world. That kind of inconsistency just would cause too many hassles and headaches.
Yeah, I think, you know, each kind of method has its pros and cons, I suppose, and each kind of use. I think some of that kind of those differences that you'll get from batch to batch can be kind of smoothed over a little bit when it comes to sort of blending things, especially if you're going to be aging stuff for a few years. Like that sort of blending process can kind of take the edge off that a touch.
Yeah. So when it comes to the actual fermentation process on the whole, what the producers are doing at this stage is very much going to dictate how things taste further down the line. So going back to the very colourful Pac-Man analogy, obviously I touched on CO2 and alcohol being the byproducts of introducing that yeast to the mix, but there are also like some other chemical reactions that are initiated from combining these things together. So, you know, you have the likes of aldehydes and esters and acids and things like that. And collectively, these are sort of referred to as congeners, which are basically flavor molecules that are going to sort of carry through the rest of the production process and should definitely be influencing the flavor at the end of the rum making timeline.
So kind of they're quite important, and it kind of, there's usually a correlation between these congeners and sort of fermentation time, really. So that was kind of, as a very simplistic rule, the kind of longer your fermentation process, the longer you leave it, the more of these sort of fusel alcohols will kind of develop. So the kind of average time for a fermentation for kind of a rum you'll get on a supermarket shelf, you're probably looking at anywhere between 24 and 48 hours. So again, this is obviously them using very fast working yeast to kind of get the alcohol content that they want. And then they'll go straight into distillation with it. But some of the weirder stuff, the more weird and wonderful stuff that me and Jack tends to drink a bit of, you know, there's examples we know of that have fermentation for 3 months before distillation happens, which makes for some very interesting rum, admittedly.
And the kind of end product is so flavorful. There's so much going on. There are so many different flavors you can, you know, you get when you nose it and then when you taste it. And more often than not, the kind of finish on those drinks, the flavors will really linger with you for a while. It's, you know, it's, there are certain rums where if you have a sip, it's all you can taste for the next hour. And that is all through, you know, it basically all stems back to this fermentation process. It's not because they've decided to add anything after the fact, artificially try and, recreate flavors. It is all purely a reflection of that initial ferment and what has been achieved with the type of yeast that's been used. And as you say, the length of time that's been fermented and the heat that's been applied, it's a culmination of all those things.
It's certainly very interesting. It'd be great if some rum distillers out there somewhere released a little series that was kind of taking each of these individual components and kind of changing them a little bit and kind of releasing a range of rums that were like that. So people could actually, you know, taste the difference between, you know, a rum made in exactly the same way, but with, say, different yeast, or exactly the same way, but with sugarcane syrup instead of molasses. Something.
Yeah.
I think that'd be really interesting. But they certainly, like Jack said, they certainly do affect the flavour an awful, awful amount. This is kind of one of the key steps in rum making that really does impact the flavour, along with sort of ageing.
Yeah. I think it is also important to note as well that, like, when we talk about, you know, things having big flavour or, you know, a shorter fermentation time or something like that, none of these is a right or wrong way to do it. It's all purely just a decision made based on what you're wanting to achieve with the final product. So there are rums that are going for a much lighter style. There are some that are going for way more heavier, funky, fruity overtones. So it's not because one person is fermenting for only 36 hours and then someone else is doing it for a week. It doesn't mean that the person that's doing it for a week is necessarily going to produce a better product. It's purely just going to be very, very different.
Yeah, 100% agree.
That's good. Good to know on the same level.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much everything, right?
I think that covers, yeah, all the bases initially. So at this point, we're now left with, we basically have this molasses and water yeast mix, or sugarcane syrup water yeast mix, that's been sat there, fermented, alcohol started, you know, to be produced, and we've basically got like a...
like really bad tasting like rum beer.
Yeah, we basically just got like a big mushy syrupy beer like mixture that's going to be roughly between 5% and 10% ABV, and that is now going to be ready for distillation. And that's a process we'll discuss in the next video, where we're going to really bump up that ABV, and it's certainly going to be formulating more of what we recognize as rum.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'll do good stuff next time. If you want to follow us on Instagram, it is just rum with it, all one word. I've started to pronunciate. Is that the right word?
Better. Nicely done. Nicely done.
Trying. If you're watching this, you're probably watching it on YouTube. So subscribe, like, comment, whatever you want to do. As long as it's nothing offensive.
Constructive criticism's fine. Just no pure abuse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, like, if there's anything, as I said at the start of the video, we're going to use this to very much just gloss over and cover all the bases in a very basic way. There's so many different directions you could go off on, you know, any one of these stages and processes. So if people want to go more in depth, if you want to nerd out a little bit, or if you want to ask us more questions or go into specifics, we'll obviously try and answer the best way we can, or if we don't know, then at least it will encourage us to look it up. We've got plenty of time on our hands still at the moment, so
what else will we be doing?
Some research.
Yeah, that's true. Right, so we'll see you all next time then, guys. Thanks very much.
Absolutely.